Thanks, you all may be seated. So this next case is called Salvador Escobedo Castillo versus the people. May I have the interim appearance, please, for the petitioner? All right, thank you, Mr. Stanley. And for the people? Thank you, Ms. Allen. Mr. Stanley, you have 30 minutes. You know how to keep track of your time, sir, so whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Justice. Good morning.
Morning.
Eric Sandler, attorney registration number 32349, on behalf of Mr. Escobedo Castillo.
Mr. Sandler, can I ask you a favor? Can you pull that microphone down?
Sure, so
I don't know which one amplifies.
Okay, is this one working?
Yeah, that's better. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. The question this court has asked is whether the jury instruction that expanded the methods of the predicate crime of kidnapping beyond the methods identified in the substantive kidnapping charge constituted a constructive amendment of the felony murder charge. In order to answer that question, we must first answer the following. What is a constructive amendment? How do we interpret what the charges are against Mr. Escobedo Castillo? How was the jury instructed? And ultimately, what did the jury find? The Sixth Amendment provides, among other things, that in the criminal prosecution, the accused has the right to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusations against him. The accused is informed of these charges through the charging document, either an information and complaint or an indictment. Obviously, here we are concerned with an information complaint. In People v. Rodriguez, this court held, that a constructive amendment occurs when an essential element of the charge defense is changed, thus altering the substance of the charging instrument. Now, this constructive amendment can happen in one of two ways. It can happen when the prosecution requests that the charging document be amended during or at the close of trial, or it can be amended by the instructions the court gives to the jury. We are concerned here with whether the jury instructions constructively amend the charges. Now, in order to determine whether or not that occurred here, we need to know what precisely was Mr. Escobedo Castillo charged with. Originally, he was charged with two counts, and those are the two counts we are concerned with in the first complaint, not with the amended complaint. In count one, he was charged with first-degree felony murder. And in that count, it was alleged that between the dates of July 11th, 2007, and July 12th, 2007, he committed or attempted to commit the crime of kidnapping. And in the course of or in the furtherance of the crime of kidnapping, he caused the death of JF. Count one neither cited to the kidnapping statute, CRS 18-3301, nor did it specify how the kidnapping was accomplished. It did not have to, because in count two of the complaint, he was charged with first-degree kidnapping of JF. In particular, it was alleged that he forcibly seized and carried JF from one place to another with the intent to have her or another make a concession or give up something of value in order to secure her release in violation of CRS 18-3301-182. Now, in 18-3301, the first-degree kidnapping statute, it allows the state to charge a defendant with alternative acts or elemental requirements. The state may allege the defendant seized and carried the victim, as it did here. It may allege the defendant enticed or persuaded the victim to go from one place to another, as per 18-3301-1B, or it may allege the defendant imprisoned or secreted the victim, as per 18-3301-1C. Each of these alternatives are in themselves a separate and distinct crime. Each creates different elements and different factual and legal defenses. So, here the state chose to allege that Mr. Escobedo Castillo committed first-degree kidnapping in a specific manner, in violation of a specific subsection of the statute. Thus, count one alleges that he committed the crime of felony murder when he kidnapped JF and during the course of or in the furtherance of that kidnapping, JF died. And count two specifies how that kidnapping, which allegedly resulted in JF's death, was accomplished.
Mr. Sandler, can I interrupt? I'm over here. Mm-hmm. Sorry. One factual question. Was there ever a bill of particulars filed in this?
Yes, in fact, there was, and that bill of particulars, that request was denied.
It was denied, okay.
It was denied.
And do you have any authority that says that a separate count, because we always tell the jury that each count is separate and distinct, and guilt of one or innocence on one doesn't spill over to the other. Mm-hmm. Do you have authority that says that how it is charged in one count means that therefore it's necessarily included in the other?
Well, yeah, I think the answer to that question is yes, because here we have a situation where count two, kidnapping, is a lesser included offense of count one, felony murder. Therefore, it is necessarily included within it. So yes, in a situation where there are two separate crimes, no, maybe one doesn't inform what happens in the other count. But here, they're necessarily related crimes. In other words, he could not commit count one without committing count two. So the kidnapping alleged in count one is the same kidnapping that was alleged in count two. And therefore, by specifying how that kidnapping occurred, they're limited by that choice. They very well could have charged in count two a violation of 18.3301, which would have included all three ways of committing that crime. By making that decision of how he committed that crime, Mr. Esposito was on notice of how he was to defend against that charge.
Can I follow up? I'm not sure I understand why the one is lesser included of the other. Do you agree that they could have charged the murder expressly based on kidnapping under a different subsection?
They could
in
have.
Which case they would have a kidnapping charge and a felony murder charge, and they would clearly not be lesser and greater offenses.
Yes, they would, because under People v. Raymer, for example, the same sort of situation occurred. I don't have the cite for that, but I can find that.
Okay.
But it's a Court of Appeals case, I know that, where the situation was the same, where you had a situation where the defendant was charged with felony murder robbery, and he was charged with aggravated robbery. And obviously the same victim, the same robbery, and the Court of Appeals did find under that situation that yes, they were in fact lesser included offenses, and yes, you could not be convicted of both the aggravated robbery and the felony murder, and therefore the aggravated robbery still merged into the felony murder.
Well, yeah, I think I remember Raymer, but we've made clear though, are you saying it's because the same victim?
No,
I mean, you clearly could have a different predicate felony and they both could be robberies. Or you clearly could have a different predicate felony. You could have a kidnapping and charge a felony murder based on a kidnapping. Could you not? And have those two be two separate crimes?
You could have these two separate crimes if there's two separate victims and they're two separate acts. The fact of the matter is that
okay.
in order to be convicted of the felony murder, it was alleged that he committed a kidnapping that occurred between July 11, 2007 and July 12, 2007. Undoubtedly, that's the kidnapping of the same individual, JF. So there's one act of the kidnapping. In order to find him guilty of the felony murder, you have to first find him guilty of the kidnapping.
Perhaps I can ask a variant of that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, without imputing a particular subsection to the mm-hmm. felony murder charge, a particular subsection of the predicate kidnapping, do you believe that was an insufficient charge? Or, and therefore, the specific subsection from the kidnapping charge had to be imputed to it to make it a satisfactory charge?
No, I think the charge is perfectly fine, as it is. I mean, it's what he's on notice of, and that's the whole idea behind the Sixth Amendment construct and the constructive amendment of having notice of the charges against you. When one looks at the felony murder charge and says that, aha, it's alleged that I kidnapped this individual, and during that kidnapping, that victim died. So the whole defense was predicated on the fact that you allege that I kidnapped this individual by seizing and carrying her. And in fact, that is how the defense was. And in fact, Mr. Esposito was successful in defending against the kidnapping charge.
Let me ask one other variant of that. Would you see a problem and would you come out the same in your analysis here if in the kidnapping charge the prosecution had specified all three sections, all three ways of committing kidnapping, and said it was a felony murder because the victim died during the course of a kidnapping by forcible seizure and carry and by, you know, persuasion and whatever the three things were. Would that be an okay charge?
That would be a fine charge. And in fact, it would have been fine if they didn't specify anything, because then you're noticed that you could commit kidnapping in one of three ways, and you would have to defend against all three of those ways. The problem here is that by making that specification, the presumption is, and that presumption was clear at the time of the motion for judgment of acquittal, is that is what Mr. Esposito was operating under the assumption of. Because the argument made at the motion for judgment of acquittal, the pre-verdict motion, was, hey, they didn't prove that I seized and carried that individual. You didn't prove kidnapping. Because you didn't prove kidnapping, you can't prove felony murder.
And so by bringing in the arguments, are you suggesting that more is necessary here than simply what was in the charging documents for this imputing of the one kind of kidnapping to the other?
I don't think it's a question of imputing, Your Honor. I go back to the fact that I think it's a question of one's included in the other. They are both referring to the same act. And in those cases, for example, that the people cite to, which is Malio and Steiner, those were completely different acts where you're saying that, no, count three doesn't have anything to do with count two because they refer to different acts. So how can you infer one from the other? Or in Steiner was with the question of the failure to allege jurisdiction.
One follow-up, and I'll let you get back to your, sure, to your train of thought. When we talk about included, we for a long time have talked about the Blockberger elemental test.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, had the prosecution specified the three subsections, clearly the kidnapping charge, which specified one subsection, would not necessarily be included in the felony murder charge. Is that not right? Even if it's the same act.
Under the... That's an interesting question. I still think that they would have had to merge under that situation when it came down to kind of the sentencing issue as the lesser included as far as the felony murder is included, because there were the same elements. No, you didn't have to prove all three, and I guess it would depend upon how the jury was instructed under the with regard to the felony murder. Here they were instructed that, okay, you needed to find kidnapping. You can find kidnapping one of these three ways, A, B, or C. Under the kidnapping, they would say you can only find A. And under the felony murder here, they found B. They found B but didn't find either A or C. So I don't think that would be the situation. And generally, if they tried all three, you wouldn't have to specify which manner of the kidnapping was found. So you wouldn't have that issue, wouldn't come up. Does that make sense?
Sure. Mr. Sandler, can I ask, down here,
sure.
Can I ask a follow-up? And I really don't know the answer to this. On the three different ways they can charge kidnapping, are they different levels of offenses?
All three of those are first-degree kidnapping. They was also charged with second-degree. Second-degree kidnapping requires the seizing and carrying, but doesn't require the being held for the ransom or some benefit. What distinguishes the first degree is the additional thing of holding someone to gain some benefit. But A, B, or C, the seizing and carrying, or the imprison or secrete, or entice or persuade, they're all first-degree kidnapping charges.
And all same level felony.
So all the same level of felony, okay. And it's a first degree if the injury occurs and second degree if injury does not occur.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Sandler, that being the case,
mm-hmm.
You keep emphasizing three distinct crimes, right? What attorney, what defense counsel worth his or her salt would simply rely on the notion that the predicate offense for felony murder is defined by another count? Particularly in the absence of any clear authority from this court or even from the Court of Appeals, arguably, that says that there is incorporation. Isn't that almost ineffective per se?
I don't think so, and I'm not going to go there with trial counsel, whether trial counsel is ineffective in this,
well,
in this situation.
I'm not asking you to get into Strickland. It just seems to me that counsel would not assume that the separate count defines the predicate offense by incorporation, where there's really nothing legally or factually to indicate as much, is there?
Well, there is. I think there is something legally or factually to indicate as such, because they both refer to the same act. And if you're alleging, if I was looking, quite frankly, if I was looking at a complaint that said that I committed kidnapping, and that during that kidnapping, this victim died, and count two, which says, oh, and you kidnapped that victim and you did it this way, I would look at that and say, oh, this is the way you're alleging that I committed that crime. And in fact, by filing bill of particulars, which said you have everything you need, the presumption is that, okay, well, I have everything I need, then count two, which specifies how I committed that crime of kidnapping, which forms the basis for the felony murder, is how I have to defend this case.
But even in this case, counsel did not universally make that assumption, right? There were instances where defense counsel seems to understand that it could encompass other permutations, other forms of the first-degree kidnapping, right?
Well, that certainly wasn't the argument made during the motion for judgment of acquittal.
either pre-verdict or post-verdict, that wasn't presumption made at all. The argument was made that the presumption is that it's you have to prove seizing and carrying. That's specifically how you alleged it. It would be the same sort of thing, and I think it's People v. Petchko, which the Court of Appeals and kind of ignored their own decision, which is the same sort of situation. I think that was a aggravated motor vehicle theft case, where the question is whether or not the individual took the car without consent or used the car to commit a crime. And I'm not sure which one he was charged with and which one he was convicted of, but the presumption was he was under one, but he was convicted under another. And the court there held that was a constructive amendment because the presumption was that you charge him in a specific manner, and by specifying the manner in which that crime was committed, that's the notice that was given as to what the charges were against him.
Counsel, you've emphasized that the purpose of this was to give notice to the defendant of the version of kidnapping at stake. Mm-hmm. And I guess my question for you is, and how would that have impacted the defense in this case, which was there simply was no kidnapping, period. It wasn't kidnapping by one means or another. It was no kidnapping at all. So how what's the prejudice here, I guess, to the defense that was actually made?
I don't think the question is what the strategy is or what not. I think what we need to look at is what the ultimate result is. Here you have a situation where he's charged with a specific crime, and in fact, he was successful in defending against that specific crime, which can be seen by the fact that he was acquitted of both first-degree kidnapping and second-degree kidnapping, which both require seize and carry. So regardless of what notice was, he was successful in defending against that crime. And in fact, the only reason that he was convicted, in fact, under the felony murder verdict, it was found, I think, that he enticed and persuaded, and that was the only one that was checked. So if in fact a constructive amendment occurred, and if in fact he was only being charged under that particular crime, he would have not been convicted of felony murder. That's the prejudice here.
And so the focus then, I guess, of your argument is the very specific crime with which he was charged and convicted, and not so much notice in terms of putting me on notice of the defense that I need to put together. I guess I'm trying to assess the prejudice for double jeopardy purposes, or prejudice for this is the defense that I put on
at
trial.
I think it's prejudice for double jeopardy purposes is what we're looking at here, because he was acquitted of the crime for which he was charged. And the simple solution here would be to vacate the felony murder conviction and reinstate the second degree murder conviction, which I believe was merged into the first degree.
You're letting your voice drop a little bit. I'm sorry. I'm not.
I'm sorry. I probably stepped away from the microphone.
That's okay. I'm just not hearing the ends of your sentences.
Okay.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So, could you repeat your answer to Justice Marquez's question, please? If you remember the question,
if she will tell me the question, then I will give the answer.
I'm just trying to understand I guess where my question is really getting at is the purpose of providing this information in the charging document, and whether it is strictly a notice in terms of here's what I'm charged with, and therefore it's going to impact the defense that I put on, or whether it is notice in the sense of this is a specific crime with which I've been charged and then convicted of, which may have double jeopardy or merger consequences.
And well, I have even a better answer, because I think it's actually both.
Okay.
Because I think that it's A, how are you going to structure your defense of defending against a crime, and B, knowing that you're not going to be charged again for the same, for something different. So in the situation here, that by going forward with kidnapping, seize, and carry, if he was... If he was acquitted of that, they couldn't come back then and say, well, now we're going to charge you under 1833011B because it's a different offense. So it's both. So I think it does impact both. And here I don't know whether or not the defense would have changed or not. I do not know how Mr. Kling would have addressed the case or approached the case if the situation was different. But the fact of the matter is, he was acquitted of what he was charged with, as far as the predicate felony. So in that sense, it's a double jeopardy issue. And so the end result would be the vacating that conviction, and he cannot be, since he was acquitted of that conviction.
Although, as you acknowledged before in answering Justice Coates' question, had the complaint said 1A, 1B, 1C, there would have been nothing wrong with that, right?
There would have been nothing wrong at all. Or if it just said 1833.01. I don't think it would have been. I don't think there would. I think you are noticed that it could be that you know that you can commit kidnapping in one of three ways. They've charged it globally, so to speak, and then you're on notice that you have to defend against all three, and that you're and those are the charges against you, and that they can't come back.
And you're on notice for jeopardy and merger purposes.
Exactly.
So the judge shouldn't have given this instruction on the other two theories, right?
Exactly.
And it was objected to?
Therein lies the problem here with this case, because I'm not sure. I really don't know. Yeah. You know, this same argument that I'm making to you, it was made during the motion for judgment acquittal. That same precise argument that they are limited in count one by the manner in which they charged count two. So that argument was made, and the judge clearly rejected that argument. Whether or not that particular instruction was objected to, not, you know, unfortunately, what occurred here was that but the conference was not recorded. So what precisely happened in the chambers there, I don't know. I truly don't know. Obviously, it does not appear that afterwards, when they came back and were finalizing the instructions, that there was an objection leveled at that point in time. But the point of the fact is that the argument was made, and the judge rejected that argument. So in that sense, as far as being unnoticed, what the argument is, that ruling was made. So,
and could I ask you, I can't remember now, but I, and when was the motion for judgment of acquittal made? Or was it really a motion notwithstanding the verdict?
Well, there was both. There was two motions. There was a post-verdict motion made, you know, written motion within 10 days made, and an argument was made after the trial. But at the close of the people's case, regular Rule 29 motion was made at that point in time, and that argument was made at that point in time. So prior to the instruction conference being held, there was an argument made that you are limited in count one by what's made in count two. So the argument was made and notice was made, but whether or not the specific instructions and verdict forms that were given were objected to, that I cannot answer that question.
But the jury does have verdict forms where they can pick the other theory, right? And the evidence supports the jury's verdict, does it not?
Well, the evidence does support the jury's verdict. I don't think I would be up here arguing insufficient evidence. No, if that's the question. So yes.
Yeah, that's the question, and you answered it straightforwardly, and they checked one of the boxes that was on the verdict form.
They were informed that they were to check all boxes that apply.
Right.
And either 1A, 1B, 1C, or second degree kidnapping, and the only one they chose was 1B, I believe, which was entice and persuade. So they made a specific finding, and in fact, by acquitting him of both count two and the lesser included second degree kidnapping, they specifically made the finding that he did not, or at least that the people did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he seized or carried her.
Can I ask a follow-up question to Justice Hobbs about the way in which the instruction conference was done? They were in chambers and it's not recorded. Then they came back out, and there was an opportunity to put on the record things that counsel wanted to.
Exactly, there was.
And am I correct that there wasn't a specific objection to the form of the instructions?
No, there was not. There was not an objection at that point.
What do we do with that? I think, am I correct in hearing you say you're asking us to assume that there was an objection done because there was an earlier one done?
No, I'm not asking that at all. Because I don't think the court can make that assumption. Right. I don't know. You don't know. We don't know.
But it affects our standard, right?
Obviously, it's on defense counsel to make that objection. But my argument is that if you look at whether or not there should be, and I guess what we're getting at is whether or not this should be looked at under the plain error standard of review or not. But first of all, even under plain error standard of review, I think there's prejudice here, which can be seen by the fact that he was acquitted of count two, and he would have, and so in that sense, I think there's plain error. But regardless, the whole purpose behind the whole plain error analysis and the requirement to make the objection is to put the court in notice of the argument. And that argument was made. That argument was made at the pre-verdict motion for judgment of acquittal. Prior to that, the judge specifically made the finding that no, they're not limited. So he's already made that argument and lost that argument, so the judge had that opportunity to make that ruling at that point in time. So the purpose behind the plain error, the requirement of an objection, was met.
All right. If there's not another question, can I ask another follow-up? A lot of times I saw charges that were filed in a similar vein, and maybe you misspoke when you talked about the Court of Appeals case, but the felony murder case that you talked about with the robbery, mm-hmm. I can see, and I have seen, cases where they will charge the felony murder with really the lowest level felony that they could prove, such as charge felony murder for robbery, mm-hmm. but then the next charge they have is for aggravated robbery because they want to make sure they have, if they don't get the felony murder, then they have a higher penalty for the aggravated robbery. Is that what happened in that Court of Appeals case? Do you remember?
Well, I can't speak to why the DA was
charged. No, I'm not asking why, but is that factually what happened?
He was charged with robbery of an individual, the victim, who ended up dying, and then he was charged with aggravated robbery of that same victim.
Right, and so why would that not have been, why do we assume in this case that they meant to charge the force, seize, or carry component of kidnapping here? Because if they didn't specify that.
I'm not sure if the question is whether they intended to do that. It's what the defendant's on notice of.
Okay.
And in both situations, you're alleging that it's the same crime. So in that Raymer case, for example, it was the upshot of the case was that the aggravated robbery had to merge into the felony murder because it's a lesser included offense. And what's a lesser included offense is one that has the same elements. Which is why, or at least one of the elements there would be, in order to prove the felony murder, you had to prove the robbery, be it denominated as a robbery or an aggravated robbery. You could not be convicted of both the robbery and the aggravated robbery.
Right. But what I'm trying to get at is, did the prosecution do something to mislead other than leave it silent? I guess Justice Hood used the phrase assumed. Did defense counsel assume that's what it was? Or in their answer to the bill of particulars, did they say, we charged it in count two, the kidnapping? I'm going back to my original question. I'm concerned why the bill of particulars didn't clarify this because it was denied. Was that in because the response from the prosecution was that we've charged it as it is in count two?
Well, there was no specificity with regard to, no, this is how the kidnapping occurred. I think the bill of particulars may have been addressed as to how the murder happened or how the victim ended up dying. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not positive about that.
So the bill of particulars didn't address what we're talking about here today. So I need to get off that.
I'm not positive. I do know that one of the issues that's been, unfortunately, it's been a while since I did the Court of Appeals thing where the facts were.
No, I understand.
But I do recall one of the issues there being whether, you know, how JF ultimately died, what ultimately happened there. And that was one of the issues, whether
so
or not
causation.
Also, but I do know that bill of particulars was denied, and that the people's response was, you have everything you need to know to defend against this case. So I think the presumption is there that you have everything you need to know, both with regard to count one and with regard to count two as well. And I don't think it's a question of misleading. I mean, I'm not blaming anyone as far as the DA is trying to mislead, but by making a conscious choice to charge under a specific subsection, 1A, they were putting them in notice that that's what they were charged, that what he was charged with and how he had to defend the case.
Right. Thank you.
If there are no further questions, I would like to reserve the last 2 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Allen?
Which one? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Melissa Allen. I'm here on behalf of the people. So the defendant's argument is that the jury instructions constructively amended the charging document, specifically since he was only charged with one subsection of kidnapping in count two. That is the only thing he needed to defend against as the predicate crime to the felony murder charge. But his argument fails under this court's precedent in Melillo and the cases that preceded Melillo. And he tries to distinguish Melillo by looking at the underlying facts of that case, but that's not what we're talking about when we're talking about whether an information gives you notice of what you're being charged with. It has long been the general rule that each count of an information must be judged independently, absent a clear and specific incorporation by reference. And in fact, as Justice Boatwright pointed out, the jury instructions that we give our juries specifically note that. In this case, instruction number 20 said, in this case, separate offenses are charged against the defendant. Each charge is a separate and distinct offense, and the evidence and the law applicable to each charge should be considered separately, uninfluenced by your decision as to any other charge. The fact that you may find the defendant guilty or not guilty of one of the offenses charged should not control your verdict as to any of the other charges against the defendant. And when we determine the sufficiency of a particular count, we look at just that count. We don't go looking to other counts to determine what that count means unless there was a defect in form in the first place. And that's not what's being alleged, that there was any defect in form to count one, the felony murder here. So there's no reason, I guess what I'm saying, there's no reason to look.
And the felony murder charge just says kidnapping, right?
That's correct.
So that covers all theories.
That covers all theories. And in fact, had they just gone on felony murder here, felony murder with the underlying crime of kidnapping, and there was no count two, and then added, let's say, the second degree murder, we wouldn't even be having this discussion because they wouldn't be saying he looked to count two to inform as to count one. But we don't even need to go there because count one was fine on its own. There was nothing that needed to be informed or explained, like in Ahman and Palmer and some of those other cases. The only reason they went outside of looking at the count that they were discussing was because it was alleged that there wasn't enough specificity in that count. But that's never been the claim here.
As a practical matter, though, I mean, there's no question here that count two was charging the very predicate felony that was at issue in the felony murder charged in count one, right? I mean, it's
the same kidnapping.
It's the very same kidnapping.
Same act. Okay. And for whatever reason, I don't disagree with you, for whatever reason, they opted to charge it separately and to specify a subsection. But that charge has nothing to do with what they charged in count one.
How can you say that, though? I mean, if we're talking about the very same predicate felony.
Because we're looking at the information and the notice that it gives him, not the facts as they come in through trial, Your Honor. I mean, when we're talking about the issue that this court granted certiorari on, which is whether the jury instructions amended the charges, we're looking at just the charges. We have to just look at those charges, not the acts underlying them.
Right, and so I understand the defendant's argument to be sort of two parts. In other words, looking at the charging document as a whole, we've got this predicate, we have a felony murder in count one with predicate felony of kidnapping, and then the very same predicate felony charged in count two, but a specific flavor of,
right,
of kidnapping. And why is it illogical to assume, especially when the prosecution concedes it's the very same predicate felony, that this is the kidnapping or the type of kidnapping that's at issue in the felony murder charge?
It isn't illogical necessarily to make that assumption.
Okay.
But that's not the argument that was made below. I mean, if all along this is what he was defending against and he knew, and that was the defense, you know, I didn't seize and carry. And that's how I'm going to defend against this because that's how I believe it was charged. he would have been, the defense attorney would have been jumping up and down when these jury instructions on the record, when the question was asked, do you have any objections to these jury instructions? Yes. They've completely expanded kidnapping for felony murder. I didn't know they were going to do that.
Didn't counsel effectively do that through his halftime motion, though, for judgment of acquittal?
I don't think he did, Your Honor. There were like 15 pages of discussion about this for the judgment of acquittal. It's on the April 24th date, 42409, starting at about page 100, and it goes through 100. I have in here 117. Well, first of all, the argument, as you're aware, was made as far as whether these charges should go to the jury. You know, whether there's enough evidence presented for all of the charges to go to the jury. So I think it's a different kind of objection, first of all. Second of all, as the discussion progresses, if you follow along, the defense attorney at about page 114, he starts asking questions. Wait, are we talking as this relates to count one or count two? And the court says, I'm asking the question with regard to count two. And then the defense attorney says, as regards to count two, it hasn't been charged that way. They specifically chose in the information forcibly seized and carried in count two. So I don't think the entices or persuades relates to count two. So they carry on this discussion about why they can't expand what was charged in count two, and I totally agree with that, because the prosecution picked its poison, I mean, for lack of a better term. So they're stuck with that in count two. And then he goes on at page 115 and 116 to talk about why they have failed to present enough evidence as to the other ways kidnapping could be perpetrated for the felony murder. So I don't think there's ever a clear objection. He clearly raises it at the beginning, back at page 100, when they first start talking about it. But then the prosecution is like, no, that's not how we charged it. We charged kidnapping generally in count one, so it could be any of the three ways. And then we charged it with specificity in count two. Then they go back after the defense rests, they go back and they have this discussion that we don't know anything about, although the court seems to remember defense counsel agreeing with the way the jury instructions were written for count one. But regardless, when given the opportunity to object on the record, defense counsel objected to evidence of flight instruction. So he clearly knew he had the opportunity to object to anything else and didn't.
Okay.
Did I answer?
Yes. It's helpful to understand sort of the context in which this arose. I recognize that your argument about, hey, we don't look to various charges within a charging document to inform each other, and you cite Malillo, and my recollection is Malillo cites Martinez.
Yes.
And the Martinez case is interesting to me in that there you had a burglary charged with intent to commit a generic crime, without identifying what that crime would be, and then separately in the charging document, a charge of larceny. And there we held that doesn't, the fact that larceny was charged separately doesn't cure the defect in the burglary charge, because it doesn't necessarily identify what the intent to commit what crime, right?
Right.
But when you continue on in that case, the concern seemed to be that larceny could be freestanding. We're not necessarily sure that the larceny was in fact the crime that was intended to be committed. Maybe it was byproduct of the burglary. And I guess what I'm troubled with here on the facts of this case, there's no question. We're talking about the exact same predicate felony. So the rationale that sort of animated that ruling in Martinez seems to be absent here. So help me get past that.
Well, I think what we have to look at is, in Martinez, the reason you were looking further than what was charged in the felony murder, was it felony murder there, or was it just burglary?
Martinez was burglary.
Okay. Because the reason you were even possibly looking past that burglary charge is because the argument was the burglary wasn't pled with enough specificity. Here, there's no question, and there's case law to support this, that just using the term kidnapping under felony murder is sufficient, because in Raymer, it was, you know, robbery was sufficient. In Williams, I can't remember what the underlying charge, I think it might have been robbery again. So the whole question of whether you look past just that count only comes into play if there's a problem with that count, regardless of the facts. I understand what you're saying, but I think that you have to separate out the factual underpinnings of the case and the charging document itself. And here there was never an allegation that there was a defective form. So we don't need to look any further to see if, like, the prejudice can be cured. I mean, generally speaking, what this court's cases have said is when you look at an additional charge, that can help add notice for a defendant, but it can't subtract from the notice that you already have. And that's kind of what they're trying to do here, is having the count two, you know, take away from the notice that he's given in count one, which is, I have to defend against any kind of kidnapping.
Well, but actually, I think I would see it the exact opposite, that in fact, the count two adds notice, right? In other words, it didn't say kidnapping 1A1B1C. It just said kidnapping without any citation to a statutory provision, and then a very
specific. It's restricting. I guess maybe what I'm saying is it's restricting it, and I just don't think.
So you can see that it's logical, but too bad.
Right.
Okay.
I do concede that it's logical, but there are two things. Too bad, because I think the case law doesn't support it, and there was clearly not a proper objection here. All the arguments all along went to there was no kidnapping generally, not I didn't just commit this kind of kidnapping.
Well, tell me about the maybe the closing arguments or the way the defense tried the case or whatever. Is there any indication that, in fact, there was some kind of, this may not be the right test, but I'm going to ask you anyway, some kind of reliance on this predicate offense the way that Justice Marquez has said it might have been construed?
There was no reliance on it. In fact, in my answer brief, I quoted from some of the defense's closing argument, and it's specifically addressed as to the felony murder, all three ways that he did not kidnap, that the prosecution failed to show that he kidnapped the victim. It went through, you know, entice and persuade, force and secrete, whatever the terms are. But she went through pointing out that never happened. And that was the defense all along, that she went with him willingly and that she died of a drug overdose, not that, you know, he kidnapped her, but not that way.
So the theory of the defense was argued, and the jury just didn't agree with it.
I'm sorry.
The underlying due process idea.
Right.
The defense got a clear shot at its theory of the case.
Yes, absolutely.
The jury rejected it.
Correct.
Ms. Allen, can I follow up down here?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead. You quote the closing argument, and I think, I don't know that the closing argument is not relevant to what the theory of the defense is, because once the instruction's given, the lawyer's got to argue what the instruction is, right?
Yes, that's true.
Is there anything in, and I go back to this bill of particulars because it just seems like that should answer this, was there anything in the bill of particulars that they said, we don't get how the kidnapping relates to the felony murder?
No, there was never, ever any discussion of the felony murder, period. The only, on the record, on, it's February 25th, there's so many volumes in this case because I think
I'm asking you to find a needle in a haystack,
okay.
I apologize.
So, but that's why I'm pointing this out. So it was February 25th of 2009 when they discussed the ruling on the Bill of Particulars. At page 93, the people say we rest on our response, which basically referred them back to the charging document and the discovery. And then the defense says, well, and the court says, we're the third time at trial for this. Why doesn't the beginning of the trial before, you know, the transcripts with competent and experienced counsel indicate that there is sufficient information for you to prepare a defense? And he says, well, my question is, I'm still not quite certain how the prosecution is alleging this homicide took place. The only thing he says is that he wants to know how the victim died, and he can't prepare a defense because he doesn't know how the victim died.
So causation. Another area, and then I'll leave it alone. Was there anything in opening statement that defense counsel said, kind of piggybacking on what Justice Hobbs said in Reliance, was there anything in opening that they said that, you know, that would indicate that they were relying on that count two?
I cannot recall. I don't have it in front of me, so I cannot recall specifically, but from the best of my recollection, the defense from the get-go was she went with him willingly, she had a meth problem, you know, this was a tragic overdose.
And he got rid of the body.
Yeah. And he didn't know what to do, and he panicked, and that's it. But it had nothing to do with whether, you know, defending against one specific type of kidnapping.
Right. Thank you, sir.
Now, there's evidence in the record that the jury heard that he said, I did her in, because, you know.
Yes, there was a jailhouse informant.
Yeah, I did her in because I was going to maybe be deported or something.
Yeah, that was the theory of getting that he wanted to get his green card and he didn't want her breaking up with him. But that's the other part of the kidnapping that is the same in all three subsections, I believe.
Yeah.
But that's correct. And he was also heard calling his ex-girlfriend and asking her to, you know, get rid of some shoes that presumably had evidentiary value.
So my question for you is, why is it logical for defense counsel to make the assumption that you were discussing with Justice Marquez when the downside risk for the defendant is life without parole? I mean, why would it be logical to assume that count two circumscribes the predicate offense for count one, when, particularly when the stakes are as high as what we're discussing here?
I guess logical to assume in a different way, meaning it makes sense because, as Justice Marquez said, we're talking about the same act of kidnapping. There was obviously only one kidnapping and one victim. But I don't necessarily think that this defense counsel made that assumption, because again, if you look at all the arguments that are made, I think it's pretty clear once it gets pointed out to him, that's not how we charged this, he doesn't really make a fuss about it until after the jury comes back, which is too late. I think he knew all along he was defending against kidnapping generally. It was never anything else.
Are you conceding in a more general sense that this sort of feels like a bait and switch?
I'm conceding that I think it's weird that the prosecution charged count two the way they did. But I still, it doesn't matter as to count one based on this court's precedent.
Can I just, in light of your response that the general defense at trial was, she went with me willingly.
Yes.
That defense is clearly contrary to like a seize and carry type of kidnapping, but I'm now wondering, is it necessarily inconsistent with entice or persuade? I mean, if the defense is, she went with me willingly, could a jury then infer from that, yeah,
that could be entice
or persuade? And is that prejudicial in that sense?
I don't think so, because the way the enticing and persuading was presented, it had to do with the domestic violence addition to their relationship, and that, you know, he had this kind of control and mind control over her. And I think that's directly the opposite of someone going with you willingly. I mean, repeatedly throughout this case, it was there was no kidnapping of any kind. You can find it over and over again, you know, and even with the defendant's testimony, you know, it was she came on to me. It was all her, and this was an accident. So I don't think it was inconsistent.
Thank you.
Mr. Sandler earlier referenced PETCO, and I know that you talk about PETCO. I don't need to say it because you said it in your answer brief, but he comes back in reply and talks about the rationale, at least of Allman, Palmer, Richardson. There is a threat that that exists in those cases. They're all Court of Appeals cases, but there is this threat to which he refers. Can you talk about whether we should really like credence and the rationales that he's saying exist in those cases for his position? Am I making sense?
Yeah, no, you are. Yes. Those cases, Palmer, Allman, Richardson, they all deal with, as I said in my brief, a fundamentally different issue than what is in front of this court on certiorari. In all of those cases, they alleged a certain defect in form for a particular charge, like specifically alleged failures to give notice of the crimes committed. And that's why the court went to look at the other surrounding circumstances, surrounding charges, to see if the defendant was prejudiced by the alleged defect. There's been no allegation here, and still isn't, even with the question that's before this court, that there was a flaw in the way that count one was charged. And I think defense counsel actually conceded that when asked a question by this court when he was up here. So there's no need to go on and look to see what the prejudice would be, is my argument, which is why those cases are in opposite. And I don't think I have anything additional, unless this court has further questions. I would ask that you affirm defendant's convictions and sentence. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Ms. Allen. Mr. Stanley, you have a few minutes, I think.
Excuse me.
You have a couple, 2 minutes, sir.
Well, thank you. I would like to talk a little bit about the Palmer and Allman case, because in my viewpoint, the people's argument with regard to why those cases don't apply is, and I don't mean to be glib, but it's the ultimate heads you win, heads I win, tails you lose argument. It's in Palmer and Allman, the question was, well, we don't have notice of the predicate crime in the felony because it doesn't specify how that predicate crime was committed. I think in Palmer it was an issue of it was a burglary, I believe. It didn't specify what the underlying crime was in the burglary. And the Court of Appeals response was that, well, yes, you're on notice because you just need to look at the charge for that predicate crime, the separate charge. And it specifies in that separate charge that this is how that burglary occurred. So you're on notice of that. But now what we're saying is that, yes, you're on notice of that, but the people aren't bound by that choice. They aren't bound by that notice. Only the defendant's bound by that choice if, in fact, he is claiming a lack of notice. So it is no different. The fact of the matter is that if, in fact, he is put on notice of the fact that that's how that predicate crime occurred by looking at count two, the fact that it's a notice claim rather than a constructive amendment claim is neither here nor there. The people are still bound by those choices. He's either on notice or he's not on notice. And if he's on notice of it, then the people are bound by what he's on notice of. And to answer your question with regard to the kidnapping, I don't think there's any dispute that the two met, I think it was outside of the McDonald's or Burger King or something or other, and that she got in the car. And yes, there was a question of whether or not she went there voluntarily or not. So I think it does fall into whether or not went in there voluntarily or whether or not he enticed or persuaded her. And what he did say, what I didn't do was to seize and carry her. So there was a question of what was her mindset of whether or not she voluntarily went. So I think that plays right into whether or not he enticed or persuaded her to go in there or not. For that reason, what I would ask is that the felony murder conviction be vacated and that the second degree murder conviction be reinstated.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Samler, and also thank you, Ms. Allen. We're going to take a very brief recess. We hope that you'll answer a couple of the questions from the students, and then we'll come back on the stage very quickly. Thank you.